Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.
Good morning, I'm Roland Martin. Today on News One Now, a white cop in Oklahoma accused of raping 13 black women. He goes to trial. But what is the issue there? It's an all-white jury. We'll talk about the case with an Oklahoma activist. Also, presidential hopeful Senator Rand Paul is right here on TV One News One Now. He and I talk about Black Lives Matter. We also talk whether or not Republicans should have a forum specifically talking about black issues. Also, why do black folks get so much less sleep than anyone else? Could race have something to do with it? We'll talk about it with a sleep expert from Morehouse. Also, the director of the new TV One movie, Stock Option, talks about being an independent filmmaker, and his hit single, Intentional, snatched the number one spot on the Gospel Billboard charts. Gospel singer and songwriter Travis Green is in the house. Plus, it's What the Hell Thursday. You know we got some crazy stories to talk about. Let's bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. A study case out of Oklahoma. The trial of a former Oklahoma City police officer, Daniel Holtzclaw, has begun in Oklahoma City. But what has got folks concerned is that it's an all-white jury. Even the alternate jurors are white. Holtzclaw is being charged with 36 counts of rape, sexual battery, forcible order, oral sodomy, burglary, stalking, indecent exposure, and procuring lewd exhibition, all of which could land him prison for life. The 12 victims of his alleged crimes, all black females in the Oklahoma City area. This has shocked many people when he was arrested last year. Joining us right now from Oklahoma is activist Grace Franklin via FaceTime, also on my panel here in D.C. Drew Elonge, National Director for Advocacy and Public Policy for MOCA Moms, Dr. Avis Jones-DeWeaver with the Exceptional Leadership Institute for Women, and Amber J. Phillips, she's co-director of Black. All right, Grace, I got to ask you, this is a stunning story. You're talking about women, frankly, who are defenseless, if you will. And so how is this story being covered? What are folks talking about there in Oklahoma City?
The story in Oklahoma City, it's up and down. When he was first arrested and we had an issue with bail because he was out on bail on house monitoring, the story was very much in the news. Once that died down and a couple of months passed, you know, the story kind of lost its legs. Now we're back in the news. It's not covered as much as we'd like it to be. We believe that this is a national issue, that this should be a nationally covered story. Right now it's picked up the most momentum it's had because of the all-white jury, but there are also things about the case that are disturbing.
Such as? Also,
such as when he was first arrested, he had a $5 million bail. A female judge set a $5 million bail for him. Another judge came in and dropped it down to $500,000. So he was able to be on bail with a house monitor. So he had, at that time, 24 charges of aggressive sexual assault, predatory behavior, and was able to go home on house arrest. And then violated the house arrest. Mm. And everyone at the sound of my voice knows that when you violate house arrest,
right,
they pick you up at your house when you get back. He was given 14 days and then allowed to go back on house arrest.
Wow.
Next 7 or 8 months, and then the actual company that was holding his bond revoked it because he had an issue with the monitor. He didn't charge it, and for 7 hours, he wasn't monitored. So those things, how black women are valued, that, you know, you have 26, now up to 36 counts of aggressive sexual assault, predatory behavior, and you're able to be at home in the comfort of your chair watching TV, while these black women are afraid and they are trying to deal with the trauma.
I want to go to my panel here. I mean, this is a perfect example of where cops are provided the kind of leniency nobody else would get.
Absolutely. Here we have a serial rapist. There's no other way to characterize this. He's a serial rapist with the power of the badge. And so he's able to use both his authority as a police officer and his physical just hulkliness to be able to impose himself and violate woman after woman after woman. Now he has all these extra privileges, plus he's being judged by a jury that is completely devoid of the specific type of women whom he violated.
You know, I was looking at, I was reading up on the case too, and one of the things that I found very interesting is that when you talk about the makeup of the jury, that, you know, legally you're supposed to represent the demographics. And in this city, there's 50% women, and there's only 16% African American, but Oklahoma is the second highest, has the second highest rate of incarceration of black men. So they are, and they also the largest incarceration of women in the nation. And so when you think about that, they're making the pool smaller and smaller and smaller. So if you have a jury of mostly white men and white women, and what the culture says about black women and the devaluation of us, you most certainly know that this case is going to really set a fire in the city.
Amber?
I feel like at every end, he's being supported because of his policeness and the authority he yields. And I'm also interested in the fact that the jury is all white, and that is a reflection of how we select juries. Even though we're not supposed to discriminate in jury cases, you have a system where we're picking jurors from voter registration files and from motor vehicle departments, and that is a place where a lot of black folks were being cut out of being a part of our justice system.
Grace, I want to go to you. I got 30 seconds before I got to my next story. Are you and others, how are you monitoring this case? Is anyone live blogging, live tweeting? How can folks follow what happens in this case?
You can follow us on Twitter at OKCArt4 and Justice. We are on Twitter. We're on Facebook. We are monitoring. We do go down to the courthouse and show support for these women, and we've been there from day one, and we will continue to monitor and watch this case.
All right, Grace Franklin, we surely appreciate it. Thank you so very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Folks, let's turn to a race for the White House. Senator Rand Paul, who is running for the Republican presidential nomination, he, of course, is one of the candidates, some would say second-tier candidates. You look at the polling data, but one thing that he has done more than any other candidate is really focus the issue on criminal justice and other issues. He's one of the few candidates who actually has talked about Black Lives Matter. And so in our conversation, we will talk about that issue, but also whether or not Republicans need to have a black forum to speak specifically about issues that you care about. Here's my discussion with Senator Rand Paul. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul is running for Republican nomination for president. He is focused on a number of critical issues, including criminal justice reform. And so he is here, first appearance right here on News One Now on TV One. I'm certainly glad to have you here, Senator Paul. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
All right, so let's get right into it. First off, I want to get the policy. When is Candace going to stop complaining about these debates? I mean, my goodness,
you know, all I would ask is, you know, some people say, no, we want Republican moderators. I think that's crazy. But I think it is not too much to ask that we have objective moderators. And I've done a lot of interviews with probably almost every national person on television. And I can tell you 10 right off the bat that I cannot tell whether they're a Republican or a Democrat. That's who I think ought to be moderating. There are many people who are partisans on both sides, but they really shouldn't be moderating.
Well, some folks actually care about issues as opposed to entertainment value. And I think what you've seen is a lot of entertainment back and forth.
I think you're right. And I think the thing is like, for example, I had to work very hard to get 30 seconds in on my tax plan, but there's like six tax plans. We should let each candidate present at least a minute about what their tax plan's about and what are the contrasts between the two. Like, if you're Rubio, what's the Rubio tax plan? What's the Paul tax plan? What's the Bush tax plan? I think you could watch for 2 hours and not know what anybody's tax plan was by the time you got to the end of the 2 hours.
Right. Of course, you will hear about comic books and all kind of other stuff like that, and fantasy football, which is hilarious, which is unbelievable to me. So policy, I think, is critically important. And so what I keep getting from African Americans is I'm not hearing what actually matters to us. And so what's interesting to me is in asking you, one of the things that is major, entrepreneurship for African Americans. Black women start businesses at a faster rate than anybody else. In 2013, Wall Street Journal, actually 2014, Wall Street Journal had a huge piece showing that African Americans got less than 2% or $23.09 billion in small small business loans, 8.2% in the last year of President Bush. If you're president, how will you change that to ensure that capital is flowing to African Americans who want to be entrepreneurs, who want to grow businesses, who want scale, but who simply can't get dollars?
Right. As far as government money, I think it has to be equal protection under the law in the sense that everybody should have equal access to it. And we need to be very certain that it is dispersed in that way and that there isn't any, even if it's not overt, that there's not a racial outcome to the way money is dispersed. But above and beyond that, something that's a much bigger pie of money is something that I want to do called economic freedom zones. And that is to leave extraordinary amounts of money in communities and encourage businesses to go to those communities, hire people, and have businesses there. Now, it's easier said than done. Everybody's been saying this for decades. But what I would do is do it in a dramatic fashion. So the south side of Chicago is pretty poor. I was down in Inglewood on the most dangerous corner of probably in America, right across from the O Block housing project. And I went around with a local minister and we talked about how we'd rejuvenate that. My plan would leave $3 billion in the south side of Chicago. I wouldn't send it to the Chicago government. I wouldn't send it to the federal government. I would just simply leave it in that area. And so businesses that are already there will thrive. That's the best way to create jobs. If you're already in the south side of Chicago and you have 20 employees, the best way to make a job is to let you get 30 employees. Starting from scratch is always harder. But I think we'd get both. And then we would encourage people who move in to have a very low tax rate. So if you're the vice president of a bank in the suburbs of Chicago, you're going to pay 30% or whatever the income tax is. But if you move to the south side of Chicago and you'll sit there and live there and have your bank in the south side of Chicago, you'd pay 5% income tax. I want it so dramatic that everybody wants to move there. The people want to actually move to that area and say, gosh, I can make twice as much money here. Money counts. Money talks.
Well, and speaking of that, I mean, one of the reasons also folks are not able to get loans because it's tied to housing. 53% of black wealth wiped out because of the home foreclosure crisis in this country. I've been very critical of the president's housing policies because I believe they have not properly impacted those who are most in need. What is your housing plan? Because we know most Americans, their wealth comes from owning their home. And that money that black folks lost, some will say it will take two generations just to recoup that money that was lost.
No, I think that's a big point. You develop capital and you get richer generation to generation when you have a house. I mean, that's where most Americans' capital is tied up. One of the things that I think in the minority community that is really bad is that you don't have inheritance in the sense that many people don't. But the one thing you do is you pay everybody, every working class person pays payroll tax their whole life and it builds up, but you don't get any of it. Your kids don't get any of it because there's no inheritability to Social Security. And I know this may be controversial, but I would individualize Social Security accounts. So your name's on it, and just the same way you'd type in your number for a 401k, you'd type in your number in your Social Security account, you'd say, wow, I put in $100,000 over my working career, and if I die at 65, my kids get it, you know? And then there'd be some inheritability and we'd develop wealth over time. But we have a system now that it's gotten too involved in so many things that there's not enough money even for those on Social Security.
So if you have, turn 65, so let's say you look at the death rate of black men younger than anyone else. And under your plan, let's say if someone dies at the age of 60, so you're saying that that's essentially money that is accrued and then that money will then go to a family member when you pass away.
Exactly. It'd be inheritable because what happens now is initially Social Security worked on everybody dying young. Now there is a racial disparity in death. Black men do die younger than the average population for the at whole. And so I think it is a real problem, and you would have some capital begin to form generation to generation. But the bottom line is we have to create a more opportunity in society, and that's why I've said, see, we've had this problem, and unfortunately we've made it a partisan problem between Republicans and Democrats, but we've had enormous amounts of poverty in our cities for decade upon decade. In the 60s, we started the war on poverty. But I think we still have enormous amounts of poverty, enormous amounts of incarceration, drug problem, back into prison, out of prison. And there's, in some ways, not a lot of hope. And I think we ought to, at the very least, talk about something new and different than what we've tried in the past. And to me, that's created enormous incentives, not little incentives, not a little tax credit here or there, but enormous incentives that people would want to move back into the city or into the city and bring their business into the city.
But you also have tremendous poverty in rural America.
You do.
How do you see getting rural whites to realize that they're in the same economic and educational condition right. as blacks and Latinos in inner cities. And as I always say, broke is broke.
We have the contrast in my state, for example. We have a large rural white population in eastern Kentucky that lives in poverty. And you've heard of Appalachian programs. We've had this for decade after decade. But just like our inner city programs, they haven't necessarily worked. Some of it's harder to grasp. It's sort of not as tangible, but it's education. And education is real and makes a difference. But I'll give you a contrast. I grew up and went to public schools in Texas, in sort of a suburb.
Same here.
Yeah, richer sort of suburb.
Not suburb. I got you.
But I had anatomy and physiology, physics, calculus, all in high school. I had a great high school. It probably rivals private high schools. So public high schools can be good. But I've also visited parts of our cities, mostly our cities, but probably also rural America as well, where they don't teach any of those courses there, and 50% of the people drop out. I would give every kid in America the choice to go to whatever school they want. So if you live on the south side of Chicago and there's a rich neighborhood that's about 15 miles from you and your mom or your dad will drive you out there, I'd let you take your money and go. And I'd say it's yours. It's a voucher and you can go wherever you want. Then what would happen is competition makes us all better.
Now, is that vouchers for all students or would it be based upon income?
I do it for all, but I mean, in what they've done in some states, in Florida and other states, is to start out with doing it, and I'd vote for any of it. So if they started and they said, oh, we're only going to do it for underprivileged kids, I'd vote for that too. But really, I think choice makes us all better and will make all the schools better. The other thing that we need, and there's a miracle waiting to happen, but the educational establishment is in the way. The miracle is the internet. And we think, oh, we'll give every kid a smartphone, they'll be smart. That isn't it. But connect every kid to a great teacher. So let's say I live in a little tiny town in, let's say, Alabama, 100 miles away from any place, and there's only 500 people there, and there is no calculus teacher. The internet should connect me. If it turns out that there's a bright kid in that school that wants to do advanced science or math, we should connect them to a teacher in Boston. See, the internet should connect you around the world to the world's greatest teachers. Then I'd also pay some of the world's greatest teachers, like NFL players or NBA players, because I'd find them and I'd connect them to every kid. But one teacher might be giving a lecture that, say, the introductory lecture in calculus. She or he is so good at it that everyone in the whole country may listen to that introductory lecture because it's so good. You would still have a local teacher, but you connect some of the best teachers in the world. That is a miracle waiting to happen that will bring great education to every kid in every school everywhere. Then you have to have some other things, discipline, keep drugs out of school, things like that. But there is a miracle waiting to happen in education. But I think people who live in poor circumstances aren't getting the same education that kids that live in a better area.
Let's talk criminal justice. What we're seeing now is, and I want to get, what are your thoughts about the Black Lives Matter movement? I believe what you've seen is you've seen this movement force a level of transparency and change we have not seen when it comes to law enforcement ever. 40 new laws passed in 24 states. You see NYPD all of a sudden, cops have to now mark excessive force. You're seeing body cameras. Yet the movement is constantly being attacked, I think, because, frankly, they're forcing change.
Well, you know, I'm for most of the change, and I'm for most of the things they have supported. I'm for the, you know, the cameras. I worked with Congressman Scott on reports of deaths in the hands of custody. I thought the Eric Garner case and all of these other cases were just real tragedies. The only thing I've hesitated with making it all about race is when you look at the war on drugs and you look at incarceration, there is a racial disparity, no question, and it is a problem we need to address. But when you look at policing, and like I read one the other day, someone was thrown to the ground and treated, I think, awfully. But one of the policemen was black. Police chief was black. So if we make it all about race, we're going to mistake the problem. What we really need to understand.
For police is blue, because you're right. I mean, look, you have police officers who are African American. There are some in the Freddie Gray case in Baltimore who were indicted.
Right.
So that's what I'm saying. I don't necessarily think Black Lives Matter is about white cops versus African Americans, although you do hear that.
Right.
I think it's a question literally of just law enforcement, this culture, this attitude where it's protect blue, where it's protect and serve. Right. A lot of times, themselves versus the public.
Right, but what I would say is it's police behavior, but there are a lot of good police too.
Yes.
And then there's also it's policymakers. So I tend to like it's sort of like when something happens bad in war, the soldier's responsible maybe for something that happens, but really the policymaker's responsible for putting that position. Eric Garner, for example, the mayor wants tax money and they don't want you selling illegal cigarettes, a huge financial thing. Mayor de Blasio has been a big part of that, but he doesn't want to accept the blame for his policy. He instructed the police to take people down. Now, he didn't instruct them to kill Eric Garner, but he did instruct the police, we're going to take down, we're going to have a zero tolerance for cigarettes. He didn't even have any cigarettes on him. It was ridiculous. And nobody deserves to die that way. But the thing is I blame the policymakers who are like, let's have the police stopping rapists and murderers, and some guy wants to sell a cigarette on the corner, let's give him a ticket. You know, if it has to be against the law, give him a ticket. If he comes back, give him another ticket. If it comes back, I mean, there's a lot of other ways to treat this other than saying we're going to have a zero tolerance and we're going to use force against somebody selling cigarettes on the sidewalk.
But do you believe that the Black Lives Matter movement has forced the kind of accountability that has been positive for the country?
They're drawing attention to issues that need to be drawn to. And like I say, I support almost all the criminal justice. The president and I don't get along on very many issues, but we're in complete agreement on the criminal justice. And when the president's trying to fix some of the crack versus powder cocaine disparity in jail.
Because it's still 18-1.
Yeah, I'm supportive not only of what he's doing, he's releasing some of the people who are nonviolent criminals, but I would change it to 1-1. And in fact, when the criminal justice bill comes forward, they don't have it in the current bill, I will try to amend that. I'm also going to try to make some felonies to misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. I'm also going to try to allow some of the expunging of records that Senator Booker and I have worked on. So there's a lot of good stuff. The only thing I don't want to do is, and I think it misunderstands, because I have a lot of policemen that protect me. Many of them are African American, and I ask them about it, and they don't want to make it about race because obviously they're black, patrolling black. It's what we have to do is change the law about the war on drugs. There's no reason we should be arresting everybody for marijuana, because what happens is the police go into the inner city, mm-hmm. and then they're arresting. So the arrests end up being 15 black kids to one white kid, but the surveys show white kids smoking pot just as much as black kids, but the police are always in that area.
Right.
And it isn't overtly say, oh, let's go round up black kids. It just happens they're in a poorer neighborhood and there's a higher percentage of African Americans there.
Last question for you. You have been demanding that Republican Party do more in terms of reaching out to African Americans. I've been saying Republicans got to stop being afraid to talk to black people, visit with black folks. Should there be a Republican forum, town hall, if you will, that specifically is speaking to issues of African Americans, of these various candidates, to talk about these issues that, frankly, you're not going to be here brought up by CNN, MSNBC, or Fox?
If we were smart, we would do it. And I've been trying to go places because you know what I find all the time? People aren't jumping up and down and saying, when I go to the south side of Chicago, not everybody's coming up and saying, hey, I want to be a Republican. But, you know, they're saying, you know what? We want somebody to compete for our vote. The Democrats take us for granted, and they never come down here anyway because they know we're all going to vote Democrat. We're not sure we're a Republican yet, but we do want to hear some new and different ideas, and we want people to compete for our vote. I hear the same thing in Louisville, and I'm excited about it. You know, I might go from 5% to 10% of the African-American vote, or maybe 20%, but I want to make inroads because, really, I want to represent, particularly in my state, everyone.
All right, then. Well, Senator Rand Paul, we appreciate it. Certainly come back anytime. Our show is, unlike other shows, I have no problem talking to Republicans and hearing various ideas and having a nice conversation and debate. Certainly appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right. All right, we come back. I'll chat with my panel about that particular interview. Also, later in the show, we'll also have a discussion about sleep, how race plays a critical role in whether or not black folks get enough sleep, and how is that impacting our health. All of that next on News 1 on TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
All right, folks, welcome back to News 1 Now. Let's go to my panel real quick. Avis Jones-DeWeaver, as well as Drew Elant and Amber Phillips. All right, y'all thoughts about Rand Paul?
Well, I have to say, I respect Rand Paul in that he at least tries to reach out to the black community, specifically speaks on some of the issues that are critical to our concern, has a level of specificity which is devoid from most of the Republican candidates right now, particularly the front runners. But I do have some questions. His economic freedom zone, for example, which is very similar to empowerment zone idea, I'm wondering what he would do to privilege the people who live there now, because to me, it sounds like what he's described would be just a greater engine to gentrification that's going on right now.
No, I think the suicide guy was, because we talked about going in Chicago, and business owners who are there, because that's one of the fundamental problems. If you have access, if you have a lack of access to capital, and what he's saying is, look, versus you sending those tax dollars to the city, he said they stay in that particular area to grow and develop that area.
But the example he gave was talking to a vice president of a bank in another area, trying to convince them to come over to this particular area because this is where the money is, you get the tax cut, 5%, et cetera. But to me, the other part that I think a lot of people miss and a lot of things that we've missed as an African-American community because systemically we've been left out of this is the research and development dollars. So as he's talking about this $3 billion, et cetera, the reason why we have the Lockheed Martins and the Boeings and all of these major corporations is because they got in on this research and development, which is part of innovation.
No, the reason you're the Lockheed Martins is they have government contracts.
No. Not government contracts. It starts out with research and development dollars, which that money is a lot more lucrative than what we have.
No, I understand that.
But what I'm saying is, to understand that, is to order to say we need this type of plane, we need this type of whatever, they went and got billions first to do the research to figure out what type of plane to build.
Then they got the contract.
Actually, what they did was they took advantage of
government knowledge already. For instance, it's the same thing the companies actually blew up when it comes to the internet. The internet was a creation of the government. And so you had defense contractors.
But to your point, what they do is the government say, we know we need this. We don't have time to do this. So we're going to give you this research money to really go in there further to do that. But we're not at the table.
The matter is, as long as any of these policies, he's saying it, don't make it all about race. As long as these policies are separate from a racial analysis, he's going to create more problems for the South Side of Chicago.
But I will say this, though. I understand his point when he's talking about cops, because the reality is, yes, if the situation with cops is a white or black thing, then some of the cops in Freddie Gray are black.
Right.
And so it's not a white or black thing. Anybody can participate
in white supremacy.
Okay. And what I'm saying is, I do believe that what his point is, yes, you deal with the blue. If you say it's black or white, because there are black cops. Look, you had other cases where you had black cops who pull over
stuff. Exactly.
So I understand his point, but I do believe it's important for us to understand that when you're talking about these issues, yes, in some cases it may be black or white. In other cases, it's going to be blue. You got black cops who are protecting the fellow cops.
Exactly, right. But I don't think that's the point of where he needs to be looking. The analysis needs to be who is the victim of police incursion. And typically, it is disproportionately African-American male or female.
Right. Actually, for me,
regardless of if there's good cops or not, running into a bad cop should not cost you your life.
Right, exactly. But here's my whole deal. I'm not going to sit here and trip on whether or not he wants to have that position, because if he is advocating the exact same policy change, baby, whatever you think your motive is, that's fine. Just change the policy.
Absolutely.
And so I don't want us to get caught up in, I need you thinking like me. No, long as you and I, if you're saying, let's change the policy that has a positive impact, I'm down with that. So, for instance, I need to hear the other presidential candidate actually saying, I want to change the 18-to-1 powder cocaine disparity to 1-to-1.
Right. Yes.
Because it has a direct impact as well on our communities
here. But we also see this movement of let's lessen the war on drugs, because now heroin is popping up a lot in the white community.
Yeah.
So now it is.
Right.
So thank you.
Here's the deal.
Thank
fine.
You for doing
white kids getting heroin. I don't care. Change the problem.
Exactly.
I'm good with that. I'm good
Across
with that.
Across the board, we need to do more to address these. Republicans and Democrats need to do more for black communities. And actually talking about specifics, that's an easy question. Do black lives matter or do all lives matter?
Well, but see, that's what I'm saying.
I'm no longer concerned with that. I already told you.
Well, first of all, I ain't wasting my time even asking that question. My whole point there is, again, I wouldn't know about those particular issues. And so, at least he's actually having that conversation, but is also involved in public policy to change some of this stuff, not just talking about it.
Absolutely.
And so, again, hopefully that actually happens. Mm-hmm. We come back. Black folks are getting less sleep than anyone else. We'll break down exactly why. Also, we'll tell you about this cop in Illinois who said that he was being pursued. Guess what? He committed suicide. But will he apologize to Black Lives Matter? All of that next on News 1 Now.
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News 1 Now with Roland Martin. Every weekday morning at 7 on TV 1.
Folks, the cop whose death conservative media outlets and some police blame on the Black Lives Matter movement actually faked his death to cover up years of embezzling thousands of dollars from his police department.
We have determined this staged suicide was the end result of extensive criminal acts that Glinowitz had been committing. He was under increasing levels of personal stress from scrutiny of his management of the Fox Lake Police Explorer Unit. Thousands of dollars were used by Glinowitz for personal purchases, travel expenses, mortgage payments.
Police Lieutenant Charles G.I. Joe Glennowitz of Fox Lake, Illinois, was given a funeral with full honors after people believed he had been killed in the line of duty on September 1st. But after a two-month investigation, his fellow cops say the 30-year-old veteran cop staged the death in order to discredit the Black Lives Matter movement. All right, folks. So here's another story that we saw this week that's pretty interesting. Black folks are not getting enough sleep. You can even hear the people over here yawning and everything. A recent study found that African Americans are getting less sleep than their white counterparts. On average, white Americans sleep 6.85 hours, while blacks sleep 6.05 hours. One of the causes is likely stress due to racial discrimination, according to the study. Some black folks can't sleep well because they think about their experiences over the course of the day. Dr. Kira Clark from the Morehouse School of Medicine joins us via FaceTime. Doc, how you doing?
Good. How are you doing this morning?
All right, so black folks can't sleep because of race. And that's led to a little controversy here.
That is controversial. That is. And, well, basically, when it comes to studies that have looked at African Americans and blacks in general in reference to short sleep, they've been looking at this for about 10, 15 years. And all of the epidemiological studies have said, yes, African Americans get less sleep, but they just don't know why. Mm. And it's just more recently in which they've linked up stress, job stress, as one of the ideologies of the short sleep.
Yep. So the impact there, because when you talk about health, not only is it a question of sleep, but also, again, those amounts of stress that play a role. And so, you know, I always make this point, you know, look, it'd just be nice not to have black folk problems. because, I mean, just because I haven't dealt with the same thing.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely true. And in reference to health consequences, short sleep has been linked to hypertension, cardiovascular disease, increased risk of obesity, and even diabetes.
Oh, wow.
You know, when I read this this morning, I was just thinking about, yes, there is a short sleep. But for me, the short sleep is I wake up early because I need to meditate to get ready for the day. Mm-hmm. So it's still the same thing. The worries that you have for your husband when he leaves the house, the worries that you have for your children when they leave the house, the worries and the stress that you get when you're at work, how does that really impact you? A lot of times I say it's just because I need to get up, but sometimes I wake up before the 4 o'clock. I wake up at 3 mm-hmm. because there's so much going on in my mind of how do I really set my day. So to see this in writing, as Roland said, there are black folks' problems, black problems, you know,
yeah,
really
of course,
impacts
of
us.
Course black people aren't getting enough sleep. Like when,
right.
Why would we think that we are? Why, I'm so glad this is being studied because just the pressure being black is a lot of work. And I think that people really don't understand that. Even there was a video that went out that talked about calling in black and how I really think that should be a part of some plans where the stress of being black, the stress of mm-hmm. not only worrying about yourself as an individual, but where you fit politically is a lot, especially yes. those of us who are doing this work, who are in all white environments mm-hmm. and trying to focus on ourselves, trying to get home without getting pulled over and all these things are happening. Like, of course we're not sleeping.
Yeah. You know, it makes me think of some research that I've seen around what they call intergenerational trauma. And right. the fact that we as a community have been terrorized for centuries in yes. this country leads to trauma that is passed down from generation to generation. And it seems like to me that this lack of sleep is just one other aspect of how that plays out.
Doc, so how do we change it? What are your tips?
Well, as for tips to be able to change it, and in reference to stress, I don't know what we can do from that standpoint, but
so from a sleep standpoint, what kinds of things can we do? I mean, obviously you're dealing with external factors, but what can we do ourselves to get more sleep?
To get more sleep, namely, what a lot of people need to do is unplug those electronics mm-hmm. that basically influence our circadian rhythm. So at night, a lot of people spend a lot of time on the computer or their iPad. Mm-hmm. and such, and that suppresses melatonin and delays your onset of sleep. Mm-hmm. So if I could say one thing that we could do, it would be to deplug and such that, you know, you can do something that is more relaxing to you prior to bed without electronics.
Yeah. All right then. Doc, where can we get more information about your sleep center and also the study?
It would be on the Morehouse School of Medicine website, www.msm.edu.
All right. Doc, how much sleep you get?
Well, I don't count because I have a 6-month-old.
Oh, see? There you go.
We need to start a Black Sleep Matters.
Doctors, Black Sleep Matters. Doctors always trying to change it for the, it don't apply to them. All right, Doctor, appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much.
All right, then. Coming up, director Mark Harris talks about his new TV One movie Stock Option. Also, gospel singer, songwriter Travis Green drops by the set to talk about his hit gospel song, Intentional, his new album, The Heal. It's 20 before top of the hour. News One Now on TV One.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin.
All right, folks, he had a hit single called Intentional from the album The Heal. It is hitting the gospel charts on fire and shot straight to number one. He has a unique mix of raspy, I don't know why they just write that sort of stuff. Always got this sort of stuff. Just gonna cut to the sting. Gospel singer doing his thing, Travis Green. Hey, Doc, how you doing?
What's up, my friend?
Y'all
how
good?
You doing? I'm great, man.
All right, then. So how's it feel to have a number one song?
It's fun. It's tiring, but it's fun.
All right, then. So first of all, let's check it out.
All things are working for my good, yeah, because he's intentional. Never failing. I know that all things are working for my good. Yeah, she's intentional.
Where's your video shot?
Atlanta, Georgia.
Okay, all right then. All right then. So so all of a sudden it goes up the charts. So you have a lot of new friends now?
Yeah. A lot. And a lot of old friends that resurfaced.
So how long have you been doing gospel music?
8 years. Mm-hmm. 8 years I've been doing it. But this past year it's just been a roller coaster and really kind of exploding and taking off.
So Intentional is a number one single. I always love going through CDs and asking folks about different songs on here. Yeah. So tell me the inspiration behind Soul Will Sing.
I just woke up one night. I'm a musician. I play a few instruments, and I woke up one night and just sat at the piano and just started singing it. And it's really kind of a hymn, and I'm not really a traditional guy, more contemporary, but that song is more traditional.
So you like Black folks with some problems sleeping, so you know you having some issues, and so you have to get up, you know, because you can be all contemporary all you want to. Uh-huh. When you're going through some stuff,
exactly.
It's amazing when you got to go find a hymn.
Right. Exactly.
To get through. I'm just saying.
Exactly.
I love the fact that, you know, people think of this thing about overnight success, but you're saying you've been in the game for 8 years.
Yeah.
What's it like to spend that much time grinding, mm-hmm. and finally have it pay off?
I think it was more me than anything. I think God was really doing the work in me. Mm-hmm. And over the past 8 years, he really extracted from me the ambition to arrive to a place of success. And I found contentment in him and with my family, with my wife and my one-year-old son. And so when I stopped looking for it, it found me.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's awesome. So I want to go back to this song, Intentional. This one of my mantras this year. I actually have it on my Facebook cover. Wow. It's Intentional.
Yeah.
I want to be an intentional wife. I want to be an intentional studying the Word of God. I want to do all these different
sure.
things. So when you came up with the song, what is it? I know you said that God is intentional. What inspired that particular song, and how is that related to when you were just talking about your success? Even over the 8 years, mm-hmm. you were still intentional. How did you come up with that?
Yeah, the song is really based off of my favorite scripture, which is Romans 8:28.
Yes.
It says that all things work together for the good of those who love the Lord and are called according to his purpose. And so the revelation in that is that anything that's happening in your life is not happening to you, but it's happening for you.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I really started understanding that, really that, and the collision between that revelation and revelation of that God allows things to happen to us,
mm-hmm.
and whatever that we're going through, it's not over until it's good. Mm-hmm. And so understanding that, you know, anything that he allows to happen has to be based on his intent.
Yes.
All right, then. Well, again, folks, the CD, it is called
The Heal.
Sticky. The Heal. The number one hit is Intentional by Travis Green. And got a little bow tie working there. Look at you. Right. You have a bean pop before you shot that?
That's a technical foul right there. That's a technical foul.
appreciate it. Thanks so much. All right. Thanks so much, Doc. All right, then, awesome. Folks. Also airing this Saturday on TV One is the movie Stock Option. I had a chance to catch up with the director, Mark Harris. It is about a homeless former stockbroker, played by Mean Joseph, who takes refuge in front of a modeling studio where he meets a young model, played by Anthony Smith. The movie also stars actress Tasha Smith. Here's my chat with Mark. For this movie, where did the idea come from? Because, I mean, it is pretty interesting. A woman gets hooked up with a homeless guy and gets him back on his feet.
Well, the idea came from basically wanting to inspire people that no matter what condition we're in, we can always be redeemed. And so I wanted to tell a story about, and then also sisters get a bad rap as far as being gold diggers. And so what I want to do is I wanted to inspire people to, no matter what condition that we're in, to, you know, always know that we can always do better. So that was the motivation for the screenplay.
And this is not a drama. So is it it's a romantic comedy, correct?
It's a romantic comedy, yes.
You know, in Hollywood, it's like, oh my God, these don't do well for black folks. They talk about, you know, Just Right and films along those lines. But the reality is black viewers watch romantic comedies just like anybody else.
Yes, you know, it's interesting because black people, we want to see and we encourage, you know, black love. And that's what we try to do. But we also try to put some type of positive message within our films, the ones that we do. And again, in order to inspire people, to encourage people to, you know, just to do better. But black people want to see black love and want to see ourselves in positive images on the screen. And that's what, you know, and that's what we do.
Would we classify as an indie filmmaker? Or does that have a different connotation for you?
Oh, no. I mean, I don't mind being an independent filmmaker. I know I love the career that Spike Lee has because he can go off and do independent films, and also he can do studio films. I think that's like the dream, the ideal dream of a filmmaker, to do what you want to do at the end of the day, but also you can go back and have the choice of doing studio films. So, you know, but calling me an independent filmmaker, you know, because I am, I do make films independent of the studios, but I get the chance to do the type of films that I want to do. And I have no problem with that at all.
And obviously, I think it's important by having a TV One, by having, and you look at the other networks out there, I mean, for African-Americans, for black directors, I mean, for you, you really have more options now than you ever had before.
Yes, we have, like, with, again, I've had films screened on BET and TV One. I was blessed that stock TV One was picked up, Stock Options was picked up by TV One. And to have these type of options out here for black filmmakers is absolutely amazing.
All right, then. Well, again, Stock Option airs on TV One on Saturday. Man, we certainly look forward to it. Thank you so very much.
Thank you, sir. I truly appreciate you all having me.
All right, folks, Stock Option airs again Saturday on TV One. All right, coming up on What the Hell Thursday, we got some crazy stories. Unbelievable. Travis going to stick around. Even he said, I got to stay around because they so stupid. Back on News One Now on TV One.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.
Seven. All right, you know every Thursday is called What the Hell Thursday. We get all these unbelievable, crazy, stupid, just ridiculous stories. Hey, let me introduce you to my light-skinned pal today.
Oh, we got
Deja Perez. Deja, where you work?
I work for 93.9 WKYS, thank you.
I don't know
you.
Why we don't put this stuff in the script. Lawrence Kelly, who you with?
I'm with Radio 1, Russ Parr Morning Show.
Gotcha. All right, you not at work?
Oh.
Okay, gotcha.
Two places.
All right, and Sherry Warren. Sherry?
Interscope Records.
Interscope Records, all right, of course. And, of course, Travis is hanging with us. Are you ready for this?
I'm ready, man. Let's do it.
All right, don't go over here praying because it is What the Hell Thursday. All right, police in Montgomery County, Maryland are dressing up as homeless people to catch distracted drivers. Officer Patrick Robinson went undercover and carried a sign that read, I am not homeless. I'm a Montgomery County police officer looking for cell phone texting violations. Oh. When he spotted the distracted drivers, he radioed to his fellow officers who pulled them over and issued tickets. Officer Robinson issued over 50 tickets, $83 each, during the undercover operation. See, he about to make it hard on all homeless people.
That is brilliant, though.
Can I say this? When y'all see homeless people, and don't act like y'all don't do this, you automatically put your head down. So, I mean, I just may be ignoring them.
I don't. I wait. What about?
I feel bad.
I get money.
I put put my head down, so I might be getting a ticket. I know that, because I may look like
money. You want to? I do.
Okay. Every time?
God bless you.
Can I borrow a dollar?
Whenever I have cash.
But you don't have cash, what happens? When you don't have cash, what happens?
Credit card swipe.
Flash.
Sorry.
Swipe. She flashes.
Would you give him a sign?
What do I flash?
Well, I don't know. Remember, we gonna talk about last time you were here. You flashed the whole crew. All right,
I
let's get
not.
Right.
Yes, that's what? How rumors get started.
Yes, you did.
You flashed.
Don't let me have to say play it again, Shelly. All right, let's go. An assistant prosecutor in West Virginia loses his job over a couple of spiders. When Chris White saw fake spiders in his office, he told his coworkers that he had arachnophobia and asked them to put them away. When they didn't, his solution was to wave around a gun and threaten to shoot the spiders. Co-workers say he never threatened to shoot any person and assured them the gun wasn't loaded, but he was still let go. White had been with the firm for 5 years. He's stupid.
But see, after this event, they then decided to put down a rule that says you can't bring a gun to work. So evidently, before, there was no such rule.
Okay,
in place.
But he said he told everybody I don't like spiders.
Where was it?
You don't pull a gun out for some spiders?
Where is the mental evaluation?
I warned you.
How did you get that job without
like
that?
Spiders.
What would you do to him?
Oh my God, he's gone, man. He got fired for that. Though.
I'm just saying, I Yesterday. Told you I ain't like spiders, though.
No, that's what you say. I'm gonna lay hands on you, though. You got issues. You got. Got issues.
That was a quick
issues.
Mistake away from a real big problem. Oops, one in the chamber.
No, but this is also like
the
one in the chamber.
But this is like the fool who had saw the spider at the gas station.
Yeah. Oh, and jumped out the car.
Trying to set it on fire.
Oh.
And set his car on fire.
Or the lady that jumped out the moving car with the spider.
Let me help all y'all out. Let me help y'all out. Let me show y'all something that's real quick. You see a spider.
Okay, so they were all, a bunch of them on the desk.
It was a Halloween prank. He didn't know that.
Look.
You ever seen arachnophobia?
Hold up. Spiders.
What you gonna do with arachnophobia?
Oh, y'all don't understand. I don't understand. So not here. No, can you imagine you at home and you had to call your mom and daddy?
See what
Mom and daddy, I got fired. Yeah. Son, why you got fired? I got fired. I can imagine calling my daddy, Reginald Martin Sr., saying that I got fired because there was a couple of spiders on my desk.
Fake spiders.
And I got mad and I told them, don't be putting spiders on my desk.
I did fumigate a house because of a spider.
And they wouldn't move the spiders, so I pull a gun out. My dad would say, I'm about to fly to D.C. to whoop your ass. I mean, that's my dad, he would say, I know you about to be 47, but I'm going to fly to D.C. and personally whoop your ass because you lost your job.
Foolishness.
Waving a gun over some fake spiders.
That's stupid.
Well,
that's stupid.
Yeah, some people are emotional about
this. All right, we got to go to a break. In between the break, hopefully, Deja not going to flash nobody in the newsroom, in the control room.
You?
It's News 1 Now
it's
on TV. I'm going to bring some spiders and wave a gun. News 1 Now on TV 1.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News 1 Now with Roland Martin.
See, y'all didn't understand. I knew what I was dealing with today with these light-skinned people over here. So that's why I had to keep a super Christian over here. Because these people are sick.
Like
so, Deja Perez, who is an imp of the devil. Lawrence Kelly and Sherry Warren. What the hell, Thursday? I'm telling you, light-skinned people. Breaking and entering is pretty high on the list of things not to do. Especially if you're drunk and breaking into a zoo. A 33-year-old Omaha, Nebraska woman, Jacqueline Eddy, broke into the Omaha Zoo so her ignorant ass could pet a tiger. Unsurprisingly, the tiger bit this fool, and she was taken to the hospital where she was treated for injuries to her left hand. She was later cited for criminal trespasses, and no, she is not black.
Oh.
Yeah, the tiger ordered carry out.
Surprised?
I didn't know That's what all she was got drinking. Dinner. What did I need to know what she was, what that was, she was on.
Where's my whitest correspondent, Tim? I'm just saying. I'm not saying. You ain't never seen one of these stories.
No.
And
the person who went to go pet somebody at the zoo was black. Nope. I'm just letting y'all know. I mean, I'm just. I ain't trying to say nothing.
There's some things we won't do.
Everything.
Right.
No, I'm just.
And no matter how drunk we are, whatever we could. I got family moonshine. Never mind.
But I'm
they're not going to a zoo.
No, you're going to get sober real fast.
Yes,
what did this fool just say? All right, then, here we go. Sports fans can get pretty intense, but no one beats this man who tattooed a New York Mets World Series victory over the Kansas City Royals on his stomach before the game even happened. Problem is, Kansas City beat the Mets. Now this fool is stuck with an inaccurate tattoo. Superfan Josh Davis told ABC he doesn't regret the tattoo because he can always add to it or change it. Okay, all right.
Change the year, maybe 2006.
But I ain't gonna take it that far.
I'ma say this.
Yeah, you ain't gonna, Kobe. You ain't gonna put Kobe. You ain't gonna.
I'ma say this. If they had relationships, if we had relationships that had that much commitment, we might not have a high divorce rate or a suicidal rate. I think if people was committed to each other like he committed to his team,
so you gonna
that's
date
called commitment. No, I ain't doing all that.
That's for you.
No.
First of all, hold up. See, you know what? You know what, right there? I knew she was already ignorant when she came out here with a cobalt blue shirt matching her finger.
I knew that.
So right there, she's trying to bring in the marriage stuff.
What kind of jacket?
Yeah. They're looking like Pete and Repeat.
Great minds think alike, boo. Hey, we don't even know each other. Great minds.
What?
That I super can't with you.
What?
Because you're extra. You're like so extra right now.
Oh my God. They just said I'm so extra.
Oh my God. Roland Martin, I totally said it. Yeah, I own it. I did. I said it.
That's a white girl voice.
You done?
That's
her white girl voice. Appreciate it.
Yeah, okay. All right, then. Y'all, don't forget, Travis, get his CD intentional, because they are intentionally ignorant on this side of the table. Tomorrow, News One Now. My girl, Anthony Smith, is on talking about her movie, Stock Option, right here on TV One. I end the show the same way, where we say 1, 2, 3, holla!
Kickstart your day at 7 and get the news you need from the perspective you want. News One Now with Roland Martin, every weekday morning at 7 on TV One.